Well, good morning, everyone. 8:06 on your Thursday morning. It's July 22nd. Sean Higgins here at the KPCW studios in Park City. Sitting in for Leslie Thatcher this week. Mostly cloudy skies at the moment with a 66 degrees in Park City, 70 down in Heber. With a full Pioneer Day weekend forecast on the line, we have meteorologist Cesar Cornejo with the ABC Forecast Center down in Salt Lake City. Cesar, good morning.
Good morning, Sean. And it is a great morning starting off today, but we expect to see those clouds linger, and actually we'll see thunderstorm chances. That's one thing that will continue for us. It'll start towards the afternoon hours, and we'll see that again, a high of 85, so a little bit on the warm side for us here in Park City, and we'll expect to see that thunderstorm chances do continue into the evening time frame, but start to die out overnight. We'll continue to see a low of 61 with mostly cloudy skies. Friday, again, partly sunny, a chance of thunderstorms once more as we continue to still see that monsoonal moisture make its way in. We'll see a high of 87, but then after that, we start to see some westerly winds aloft bring in some smoke for Friday night, where we expect to see a bit of haze out there with some partly cloudy skies and a low of 61. Saturday, we start to see mostly sunny skies, slight haze still hanging around for us, but we continue to see a high of 89 degrees. So it does become a little bit more drier. Saturday night, also mostly clear skies. 61 degrees will be our low. Sunday, we continue to see plenty of sunshine. We can expect to maybe see a spotty shower here or there as the return of monsoonal moisture does start to make its way in and its presence felt, but we'll see a high of 89 for us. Sunday night, we'll see 61 as our low with mostly clear night. And Monday, as we continue into the work week, we see the return of some cloud cover. Again, monsoonal moisture making its way in. We'll see a high of 89 degrees for us. And going into Monday night, partly cloudy skies, low of 62 for us. Again, monsoonal moisture really starting to make its presence felt. Tuesday, that's where we start to see the thunderstorms possible. And we'll have mostly sunny skies during the morning time before seeing those chances of thunderstorms pop up for the afternoon hours. We'll have a high of 86. Tuesday night, we'll see mostly cloudy skies. The thunderstorm chances die out with the sun going down, and we'll see we have a low of 61. Wednesday, we continue once again with that diurnal, just basically daytime thunderstorm activity really happening for us, partly sunny skies throughout the day and a high of 82. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Sean.
Thank you, Cesar. Enjoy your Pioneer Day weekend. Well, joining me in the studio now is Laura Smith with the Mountain Trails Foundation with this week's trail report. Laura, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. We've got a busy week out on the trails. We've got an archery event in the canyons area. So if you're heading out that way and notice people running around the mountain with with weapons, and just know that they're part of an event. So it's all safe and cool. Maybe just find somewhere else to go enjoy the outdoors. And then on a note of what we've been doing here at Mountain Trails is we started on the new Mother Urban Trail. Machine work is happening up in the area of the Mid-Mountain and King Road intersection, kind of a little bit more to the south of that. But if you hear machinery, just, you know, stay clear. Not a safe place to be. So again, that's in the Mid-Mountain King Road area. And then we have, sadly, a couple of reports of vandalism on the trails. So kind of an odd thing to happen. We sort of think maybe it's a vigilante efforts, but I wanted just to remind people that our trails are a community asset and there are people taking care of them. Mountain Trails, Summit Land Conservancy, Utah Open Lands, the city. If you ever see something out there that's bothering you, just, you know, give one of us a call. You don't need to try and go fix things yourself. usually causes a little bit more consternation than it does solving a problem. So, yeah, just a note to everybody out there, if there's something that you see needs repair or needs, you know, you think could be improved upon, please just call the land managers or Mountain Trails. We're happy to point you in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. What was being vandalized?
So the Land of Oz, what is in the winter, the Land of Oz skiing area over in Round Valley, there was some fences cut. That is private land. It has a conservation easement, but it is private land, and the landowner does graze out there, so he doesn't personally graze. His animals graze. Anyway, there was also some spray paint up in the Quarry Mountain area. There's lots of spray paint. Mountain Trails spent several hours cleaning that up. And then there was some monument plants, which are the tall kind of torch-like looking plants out on the 9K trail, which are not noxious weeds. They are indigenous. So we don't know if it's straight up vandalism or if it's just people trying to do the right thing or trying to improve upon something. But I'm going to say it again, just if there's something that you see, you think it might be wrong, just give one of the land managers, or again, Mountain Trails is happy to point you in the right direction. So just keep it cool out
there. I do think it's important to note that a lot of engineering goes into trail building, and it's really important to leave that to the professionals or people who are at least trained in that sort of thing to handle any kind of maintenance or anything like that out there.
Yeah, for sure. And we've got a big trail system, so we appreciate the eyes on trails. It's great to have a community taking care of its trail system, but when it comes to things like spray paint and noxious weeds, maybe let us know.
Mm-hmm. Anything else for us?
Yeah, one more thing. We want to welcome longtime local Jimmy Tart to Park City Municipal. He was hired as the trails ranger, so there will be some enforcement component out on the trails and mostly at trailheads, and the focus is education. It's not he's very, very clear about educating and not punishing people. So, welcome, Jimmy.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That's Laura Smith with the Mountain Trails Foundation with this week's Trail Report on Pioneer Day weekend. Laura, thank you for joining us. It is Pioneer Day weekend, and Summit County actually has quite a bit of history when it comes to Pioneer Day. Joining me now to talk about Summit County's role in the holiday, Summit County historian Joe Frazier. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It sounds great to have you on. So I think a good topic for Pioneer Day is to talk about Summit County's role in the holiday. I understand Echo Canyon is where many of the first Mormon pioneers entered Utah. Can you give us a brief history of Pioneer Day for people who are maybe new to Utah?
Yeah, so Pioneer Day is kind of confusing to those people that are new to the state, because it's not the day or date that the state of Utah joined the nation, but it's actually the date that the first Mormon pioneers entered Salt Lake Valley. And as you said, Summit County played a big role in that. Echo Canyon was kind of the gateway to Utah for those early pioneers, and not only the Mormon pioneers that settled here, but also more famous parties like the Donner Party. Later on, the railroad comes through Echo Canyon. But for Pioneer Day, the pioneers were trying to find a way from basically Fort Bridger in Wyoming into Salt Lake Valley, and the quickest and easiest way for them to do that was through Echo Canyon and then East Canyon up above Hennifer. So it was a very important, I guess, entryway or gateway into the state there.
Yeah, and I think pioneer history is huge, not only in Utah, but throughout the Mountain West, as you mentioned. They're trying to find a way from Utah across the mountains. I grew up in Lake Tahoe, so learning about the Donner Party was a very big part of my childhood. We take yearly field trips to Donner Lake to learn about the tragedy that happened there. So a lot of history with them coming through Summit County. Yeah. As well. So as you just mentioned, July 24th, 1847 is the date where the first Mormon pioneers entered the Salt Lake Valley. When did the pioneer era actually end in Utah?
So there were kind of two waves of pioneer era in Utah. The initial wave was from about 1847 through 1860. And then after that point, you had more of the handcart trains and as well as wagon trains. So there was the second so-called second wave of Mormon immigration that ended roughly, it goes from about 1860 to roughly 1880, 1885, right in there. And that's kind of considered the end of the pioneer era. And of course, by that point, the railroads coming through. So travel from the east is easier by rail after that point.
Yeah, and kind of historically, how has Summit County celebrated the holiday? I know Salt Lake City traditionally has a very big parade. A lot of other cities have big parades. What about Summit County?
Yeah, so Camas here in Camas Valley has traditionally had a 24th of July celebration. They call it Fiesta Days. Now it includes a rodeo and demolition derby, a parade, fireworks, and those type of things. Traditionally, they had some getaways up to Mirror Lake during the initial Fiesta Days. Hennifer also has had times where they've celebrated the 24th and had parades as well as fireworks. And a lot of time there were kind of reenactments of that first wagon train, where instead of a traditional parade, there were the wagon trains that kind of reenacted pulling wagons into the valley or even through Echo Canyon. So that was kind of the historical side of it, is to reenact the wagon train and the travel of the pioneers.
Yeah, and I understand that Park City was kind of settled as a non-Mormon settlement here in Utah, certainly with the mining history here. I believe the U.S. Cavalry spent some time in Summit County as well. Was Pioneer as big of a deal in Park City as it is in other parts of the state?
No, it was not as big a deal in Park City. And again, there's kind of a dual side to that, where the Snyderville Basin was more of the Mormon pioneers settled, but the actual city of Park City, as you said, was mining and not as much of the Mormon pioneers. So it was not as big a deal in Park City, and has traditionally kind of stayed that way.
Right. And kind of speaking to your role as the Summit County historian, what does that all entail? I know a lot of, like we just were talking about, a lot of pioneer history here. What else historical has happened in Summit County that you are responsible for being the caretaker of?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there's a lot of mining history and just Park City Museum and Park City Historical Society really covers that well. But we also, as Summit County history, have a responsibility to discover that history as well. And then there's a lot of history of the different settlements that is, I guess on a daily basis, I have people that come in and ask about, you know, where did my family live in this city, or what property did they own, or can you tell me where they're buried? And so a lot of what I've been doing is, you know, looking into the history of the different towns and who settled where and who lived where and the prominent people in the different towns and settlements. A lot of that is, I guess, going forward, our plan is to get as much of that online and digitized as possible so that people can research that history and be a part of that history without having to come physically to Summit County necessarily.
Right. I guess you could say that Summit County was truly the Wild West at one point.
It was, yes. And a lot of crazy stories, and that's kind of the fun part of history, is learning those individual stories and the part that they played in the bigger West.
Yes, and then how they affect today's history as well. Joe, anything else you want to add before we let you go this morning?
No, again, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
All right, that's Summit County historian Joe Frazier talking about the history of Summit County and Pioneer Day here in the Wasatch Back. Joe, thank you so much. Enjoy your Pioneer Day weekend. Well, the Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame will be hosting a special ceremony next month. The organization will not only celebrate three inductees for 2021, but also three honorees from 2020. Rick Bruff has more.
The ceremonies will be held August 25th at the Elf Indian Ski Museum in the Utah Lippitt Park. Museum Director Connie Nelson reminded KPCW that last year's induction had to be canceled, like many other events during the pandemic. The inductees for 2020 all have important connections to Utah skiing. Randy Montgomery was the head of Ski Utah and helped prepare for the 2002 Olympics as the director of the Utah Sports Authority. Howard Peterson was a major figure behind the development of the Soldier Hollow Olympic cross-country venue near Midway. And Larry Warren was a Salt Lake TV journalist for over 40 years, has written ski histories, and was a general manager for KPCW. The inductees for 2021 include Bruce Tremper, who has directed the Utah Avalanche Center for nearly 3 years, Leif Odmark, who was a longtime activist for skiing in Sun Valley, Idaho, and Wesley Wes Deist, who was a ski coach and educator for 50 years in the Idaho Falls area. The inductees are deceased, except for Tremper and Warren. Nelson said tickets for the induction ceremony are $100. To attend, you can go online to indianmuseum.org/register. Both Nelson and Larry Warren said they support an effort in Utah to once again host the Winter Olympics. Warren said it's a good idea, and we don't need to do it to boost growth in the area.
I think Park City is so on the map that hosting Olympics again really isn't going to inspire a new round of growth. I could be wrong. I look at it as just an incredibly fun community-building event that has a long run-up, but the actual inconvenience, as some people would call it, or the actual fun, as most people would call it, only lasts 10 days, 2 weeks, and it goes away again. So I just think the Olympics is such an inspiring event that, sure, I'd love to see it come around again in my lifetime.
He added that Utah has established a record different from many other Olympic locations. The venues built for 2002 have maintained an ongoing legacy as training centers for young athletes and as tourist attractions.
You know, the Olympics, rightly so, have been criticized for the wretched excess of building opulent venues that are used for a couple of weeks and then they have no after use. But Utah is the shining example of, if you plan it right and you build in the right place, you will have after use. And Olympic Park and Speed Skating Oval and Soldier Hollow are all as busy as they were during the Olympics. They're all successful venues that have managed to sustain themselves.
Larry Warren, newsman, historian, and inductee to the 2020 Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the Utah Department of Transportation announced yesterday it is looking for the public's help to formulate its active transportation plans. UDOT wants to better understand the public's need for bike lanes, trails, multi-use paths, crosswalks, and sidewalks. The comment period for UDOT's active transportation plan runs until August 28th. Active transportation is anything human-powered, think biking, walking, or using a wheelchair, and UDOT hopes the public's input will help provide better access to trails and paths on state-run routes. Active transportation is the way many people who can't drive or choose to not drive commute to and from work, go to the grocery store, or visit family and friends. Active transportation also provides an alternative to getting in a car that helps with congestion and reduces carbon emissions. In a written statement, UDOT Active Transportation Manager Heidi Gudhart said UDOT's goal is to build a complete transportation system where people have the freedom to choose how they travel. A link to the UDOT project website can be found on kpcw.org. The website has an interactive map with planned and future active transportation projects throughout the state. Well, the Heber City Council moved forward in its plans for a redevelopment project around Main Street at a council meeting on Tuesday. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on that.
Heber City approved a plan to redevelop an 80-acre area around Main Street at a city council meeting. The project area plan and budget approved on Tuesday will enable the city to divert tax revenues to projects within an 80-acre zone downtown. Mayor Kellyn Potter says the decisions involved were, in part, a step toward fulfilling a larger plan to bolster tourism and the local economy over roughly the next 30 years, called Envision Heber. She says the plan will enable the city to implement specific visions within the project area, which she says will be based on the interests of residents.
Any taxing entity in the valley, they don't have to, but it just makes it better because there's that much more revenue to use in these investments. So really, that's the next steps, is just working through some details and seeing if they are willing. We have already been talking to them and working with them. We just don't know yet if the votes are there on each of these councils to enter into an agreement with the city on the CRAs.
On Tuesday, the council voted to approve the project area plan and budget. The project area plan passed by a vote of 3-1. Councilwoman Heidi Franco cast the dissenting vote. She voiced concerns that the city had not done enough to tell property owners in the project area how they could object to the plan, according to part of the state code. The city says the budget plan for the project will not result in additional property taxes for residents. The plan designates the project area as a community reinvestment area, or CRA. A CRA is a financial tool that allows cities to reappropriate tax dollars to city projects. The city estimates this would generate $36.2 million over 20 years. Next, the city will look to enlist other taxing entities in the area to invest portions of tax revenues they receive in future downtown projects. Potter says the most crucial ones will be the county and school district. The city will look to work with others like the Parks and Recreation Department and Fire District that will agree to contribute too.
We totally support people staying in their homes in this old town as long as they want. The notion is that there may be someone that comes in, buys them out, and doesn't want to create something that would be best for the city, and this gives us some flexibility in some of those areas.
She says the city will look to work on interlocal agreements with those taxing entities within the next few months. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, as we just heard from KPCW reporter Ben Lassiter, the Heber City Council voted to approve a plan and budget for a redevelopment project around Main Street. The project has been described as an initiative to promote local economy and tourism in Heber City. The plan involves a downtown area of 80 acres and stretches from Airport Road to just south of 1200 North Street. Part of the budget plan is a financial strategy that allows cities to reappropriate tax dollars to projects within a community reinvestment area, also known as a CRA. The city projects that this can help generate $36.2 million from property taxes. On the line now to talk about the CRA is Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Matt, good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So for people who maybe aren't following this issue closely or have never even heard of a CRA, that community reinvestment area, what is a CRA and how does it work?
Sean, let me begin by saying what the CRA is not. The CRA is not a new tax. The CRA is not an increase in an existing tax. The CRA is not a tool to condemn property. The CRA is not a land use decision or criteria. What the CRA is simply is an economic tool that can be leveraged by the city to bring about the vision that was captured or envisioned Heber 2050 initiative. This vision was encompassing 18 months of extensive public outreach. And what the community said is we want the downtown to remain a strong, viable heart. And the CRA is the tool that we're going to use to try to preserve that strong heartbeat of our community.
And this Envision Heber plan, is that kind of born out of a visioning process? I know Park City has their Vision 2020 initiative. Is it in the same ballpark as something like that?
I think so. The Envision Heber 2050 initiative was essentially the city's general plan update. And as I mentioned, it consists of 18 months of extensive public outreach. And we heard repeated themes throughout that initiative, and that was that the downtown is important to the community. And to that end, they wanted the city to create some tools that would help bring about those goals. And if I may, let me just share with you a couple of the goals in the Envision Heber document. One of those goals, if I remember correctly, was to make downtown a regional destination for annual gatherings and traditions that Heber residents could enjoy, to take underused spaces or reimagine them into significant new places to work, live, and enjoy, to improve pedestrian and bike accessibility, parking, and traffic conditions along Main Street, and to preserve, enhance, and improve access to valued places and buildings. So what we heard is that the community wanted us to maintain that small town feel and charm, but also make sure the downtown is on solid economic footing for the next 30 to 40 years.
Right. And how has that balancing act been? I know Heber in the greater Wasatch County area has a very strong rural tradition, but also a lot of growth in Utah, where you see the Wasatch Front starting to spill over into the Wasatch back. How is that balancing act, and how has that been going?
Well, the downtown has been around since essentially the Heber was established decades and decades ago. And the downtown is in a position where much of the housing or the building stock is older than 70 years. And there's got to be some way to bring about new investment in the downtown. And we believe that the CRA is a tool that will help spur private investment in the downtown to preserve what we all love and cherish. And so although there's a great amount of growth in Heber and Wasatch County, what we all agree on is that the downtown is the heart of the community, and we need to do what it takes to make sure we preserve that strong heartbeat.
So let's talk a little bit about some of this $36.2 million projected generation from this CRA. What will that money be going towards specifically?
I imagine the initial focus or emphasis would be on infrastructure improvements, specifically parking. One of the things that we're aware of is that there's inadequate parking in the downtown. So I imagine that we look at maybe purchasing a parcel or two and expand parking opportunities, potentially in the future even maybe having a parking garage somewhere near maybe City Hall. I think the other priorities would be roadway improvements, ensuring that we have proper bike access and pedestrian access to the downtown, and perhaps even some infrastructure improvements along the way of water and sewer lines, as most of those lines are older than 70 years of age.
Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit about what the CRA is not, and you said the most common complaint, I guess, you get is that this is a new tax, which you pointed out that it is not. Is that far and away the most common piece of feedback you get from the public, or are there other concerns about the CRA as well?
Yeah, I think that's one concern we've heard. I think the biggest concern is that many residents felt that the CRA would be used as a hammer to essentially condemn property and do with what the city wished to do with it. And ironically, the city has created this CRA and given it zero condemnation authority. So it has zero ability to condemn land. And so that is not part of our strategy. We're hoping to work with willing property owners to bring about some great things, but we have no condemnation authority with the CRA. The other issue we've heard, of course, is it's another tax, and the CRA is not another tax. The way the CRA generates its revenue is off existing property taxes and valuation increases that come from properties within the district. So in other words, you might have an investor come in and invest in a property, and that investment is obviously going to bring about a higher valuation, and that valuation is going to result in a higher tax, and it's that increment, the higher tax, that's going to go into the agency to be reinvested in that downtown area. As you mentioned, we anticipate about $36 million that would be generated over the life of the CRA, which is 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And as we heard from Ben Lassiter, Councilwoman Heidi Franco was the lone dissenting vote on Tuesday. She voiced concerns that the city had not done enough to tell property owners in the project area how they could object to the plan, what the plan was in the state code. What else needs to be done as far as community outreach with this project, and how long will those outreach efforts last?
So the outreach will be consistent and ongoing. In fact, we were using our Envision Heber 2050 website. People can go to envisionheber.com. And on there is a tab that has videos and information on the CRA. Before we had our public hearing 2 weeks ago, we sent notices out to every property owner within the proposed boundary. And that notice included all the state criteria that was required of us. It also referenced the state code that residents could go to and learn more about the act that the city uses, as well as, of course, call staff and call council members. I can say that we are here to provide information, and if there's ways that we can improve upon that, we stand prepared to do that.
If you had to put an item at the top of your list, what is the number one priority you'd like to use this funding for?
I think the number one priority right now would be parking. We had a CAMS meeting yesterday, and what I've heard is we need more parking. You've got businesses that want to improve their buildings, maybe even expand them, but can't because they can't meet the parking requirements. But what they could do is help buy into a parking facility, thereby allowing them to make additional investments in the downtown. So I think one of the first things to look at is perhaps expanded parking opportunities throughout the downtown area.
And talking about CRAs a little bit more generally, can you give some other examples of cities in Utah or perhaps across the country that have used CRAs, and how are they able to benefit from these programs?
Yeah, so the notion of CRAs has been around since, I think, the 1950s. There was a city in California that first that used it. I think every state in the country right now allows for CRAs. In Utah, Moab, Midway even had one recently, Sandy, Salt Lake, Holiday Village, Farmington, West Valley City, many, many cities in Utah utilize CRAs as an economic tool. Maybe the best example would be the Holiday Village, which is in Salt Lake County. And I grew up near Holiday Village, and when I grew up, Holiday Village's commercial area was nothing to write home to mom about. It was older buildings, they were basic vanilla buildings. But today, if you drive down there, what they've done is nothing short of extraordinary with their architecture, with the investments they made. They've literally transformed the area into a beautiful area with a lot of activity centers. The architecture is wonderful, and they've just done an amazing job. And again, Holiday Village is nestled up against, I think, Mount Olympus. And it's just a place that people can use as an example of what good things that can be happened from a CRA.
Mm-hmm. And a kind of a common theme when we hear about some of these municipalities in Utah trying to solve some of these persisting problems on their own is there are some accusations get thrown out about the legislature being a little too heavy-handed. We certainly hear that a lot about affordable housing. I know Heber also passed an ADU ordinance that needed to be tweaked so it adhered to what the legislature wanted. When it comes to the CRA, is there any worry that the legislature could get involved, or what are those conversations like?
I don't think so. The state statute that allows for the creation of CRAs does require that 10% of the tax increment be set aside for affordable housing. And that increment, that 10%, can be spent anywhere in the city. And so we anticipate using that to help meet our affordable housing goals that are placed upon us by the state. And so the CRA, I think, is a great tool to assist affordable housing. If you've seen the valuation increases in Wasatch County and Heber, we have an affordable housing crisis. I looked at data on Tuesday, and valuations of property have gone up 36% over last year, 36%. People who want to be firefighters or police officers or nurses or school teachers simply can't afford to live here. And that's a problem, that they can't live in the community in which they work. And so we're pleased that the CRA will be simply a tool in our toolbox to try to help with some affordable housing issues and provide housing to our heroes, nurses and firefighters and police officers and school teachers.
Mm. And we hear about short-term rentals, certainly in Summit County, are a big factor in the shortage of affordable rental units up in Summit County. Are those trends similar in Wasatch County and down in Heber? And how does this new ADU address the short-term rental side of this puzzle?
So the city's had an ADU policy in place since, I think it was 2009. So we've actually been ahead of the curve. The change that we made to the policy Tuesday night was to comply with recent state legislative changes. The state is now looking very hard at how to address the affordability of housing. And so we actually believe we're ahead of the curve in terms of allowing ADUs to be used as essentially another home, another place for people to live and to be able to do it affordably. And so we're hoping that other communities in the area, as Wasatch County and Midway, would also follow our lead and establish ADU ordinances to help relieve the issue on affordability.
Do you know off the top of your head the breakdown between short-term rental and long-term rental units in Heber?
I don't have those numbers in front of me. I couldn't tell you much about that.
Would you say there are more long-term rentals than short-term rentals, or more short-term than long-term?
I would say there's a lot more long-term rentals. I don't believe there's a lot of short-term rentals. But the bigger problem is affordability. People simply can't afford to buy into a home here anymore.
Mm. Are there any talks? I think Park City is exploring a deed restriction program to offer help with a down payment for people coming into the housing market. Is there any appetite for something like that down in Heber?
Yeah, ironically, Heber's been involved in several annexations, and when we've negotiated those annexations agreements, we require those developers to dedicate 10% of the units as affordable, meaning that we intend to deed restrict them or rent restrict them. And so we've been able to do that with several annexation agreements. We intend to do that with several others that are coming our way. We're also working closely with Wasatch County and the Affordable Housing Committee to do a countywide study to find out exactly what type of affordable housing solutions the community will afford. That's critical because once we know that, we can put in play the strategy to bring about those types of solutions. We believe it's important to align our solutions with the vision of the community, and that initiative will be getting off the ground here shortly.
We'll be looking forward to hearing more about that. Matt, anything else you want to touch on?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to talk more about our CRA and invite all your listeners to our Heber Market on Main every Thursday evening, including this evening from 5 to 9 o'clock at our main park.
Should be a great event. Hope to see everybody there. Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Matt, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Sean.
Well, COVID-19 cases are on the rise in Utah. Carolyn Murray reports on the concerns health experts have and the possibility of implementing social restrictions to quell the alarming infection rates. Once again.
On Tuesday, the Utah Department of Health announced 559 new COVID cases, up 88 from the same period last week. They reported 293 hospitalizations and 4 COVID deaths. Intermountain Healthcare epidemiologist Dr. Brandon Webb said caregivers in Utah's hospitals are starting to feel the impacts of the recent surge in cases. Some hospitals are postponing elective surgeries and procedures. Dr. Webb said the COVID pandemic is not over and the impacts reach beyond a person's health.
The reality is that the pandemic is not over. This is a terrible disease that still affects people's lives and livelihoods. It's affecting more and more Utahns every day. The consequences are not limited to health only. They impact our society and community in many, many ways. With increasing case counts, we are now again in a position where we're going to have to face the possibility that social restrictions in different venues may be necessary to control the disease, to decrease hospitalizations, and decrease unnecessary death. And all of that can be prevented through vaccination.
Dr. Webb said even those who've had COVID must get vaccinations because the new variant is highly transmissible and substantially more severe.
Individuals who've had COVID and are then vaccinated generate a very strong immune response with antibody levels up to 40 times higher and have much better protection against all of the variants of concern. And that's the single most important reason to be vaccinated, even if you've already had COVID-19.
Dr. Webb said experts have more confidence in the effectiveness and the safety of the COVID-19 vaccines than they've ever had with any other vaccine product.
More than 330 million doses of vaccines have been given in the United States in what amounts to the most wide-reaching and most thorough vaccine safety surveillance program in history. And with that, we can say confidently as healthcare professionals and providers that these vaccines are safe, that they are well tolerated, and that they are remarkably effective. And that for everyone who's been impacted by this ongoing pandemic, vaccines remain the single most important thing that we can do to decrease community transmission and get back to normal.
Dr. Webb said most Utah communities are now in high transmission levels, and he is confident the legislature will use this data when considering public health policy.
Those numbers do inform policy decisions, and especially with respect to specific situations where reinstituting precautions are necessary. And I know that those discussions are being had right now at the level of the Department of Health, in the Department of Education, with businesses and community leaders, with religious groups, with the new increase in cases, discussions about implementing social restrictions and other precautions are being had as we speak.
Dr. Webb said they expect to have vaccine availability for children under 12 in August. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, country artist Justin Moore is coming to the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday. That's actually Pioneer Day. It's a Pioneer Day concert for him. Joining us to talk about the concert is Ari Ioannidis with the Park City Institute. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning, Sean.
So, Justin Moore performing this weekend inside at the Eccles. We've seen, I believe the Institute has been hosting a lot of concerts this, not a lot, but several this month indoors. How has the indoor venue been working out?
When you think of summer, you think of outdoors, obviously. The nice thing about being inside is, the temperature's right, parking's free, easy to get to, seats are comfortable, and you hear every note. Last week we hosted a great group, Jocelyn and Chris, and Jocelyn came off stage and goes, boy, this is one of my favorite places to play. It feels like I'm just playing to butter. Everybody was engaged, the crowd enjoyed it. So far, so good.
Mm-hmm. And as you just heard from Carolyn Murray, there is concern rising COVID-19 rates. What precautions are in place at the venue for people attending? Is there any way to require vaccinations? Are there still face masks required inside?
Well, we can do a few things. First of all, from the beginning, we've exceeded what local health department and state health department regulations have been. We can require all of our staff and volunteers to be vaccinated, and they're all fully vaccinated. Second thing we do is we are still wearing masks. I kind of thought by now things would have gotten better, but this Delta variant has been very aggressive. So we've left those mitigations in place. The school district, as part of their mitigation protocols, installed better air handling equipment, touchless faucets in the restroom. So they did some things. We're doing enhanced cleaning measures. So especially for the back, the green rooms, is tough as it is on the patrons, it's even harder backstage. This particular concert, Justin Moore, they're bringing three buses, two tractor trailers. We have another box truck. This is an arena show that we're fitting on the Eccles stage. There's a lot of people back there. So we're taking those protocols very seriously backstage and in the green rooms. So that's a place where we're most concerned. And if you're not vaccinated and you're still going out, we ask that you wear a mask in the theater.
Mm-hmm. So you cannot mandate masks in the theater itself?
We could. I think we could do that. Our research shows that patrons, and this is a state study was done, patrons don't want to do that. They don't want to show an insurance vaccination card. They don't want to have their temperature taken. So we have to balance the needs between, what a patron wants and their own safety versus what, people want to do to continue to enjoy themselves inside. But so far, we've been able to really distance people. If you've come to one of the shows, thank you for coming. But you'll notice that we've had a lot of space out. And Jenny in our office has done a good job of watching groups book seats and have space in between. So this show, he's been selling out just about every venue he's been in, and this is by far the smallest venue he's playing on the tour. He's usually playing 10,000 plus venues, and this is 1,200 seats. So it's a little more of a challenge for us to keep it spaced, but so far we've been able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Given that this is the biggest show, how are there tickets still available? Is this a sold-out show?
I'm kind of shocked tickets are available, yeah. So, and I think one of the reasons are people don't know Justin Moore that well. I mean, I'm not a huge country fan, but I do follow country. Garth Brooks came last week. People were paying $1,000 for tickets. And one of our people in a meeting said, well, the day of the show, I ended up selling my tickets for a loss because I wasn't going to sit outside in an 89-degree heat, with all those people. So Justin Moore's been around for 10 years. He's 7 number one hits. His top 10s are songs that even those of us who aren't huge country fans would know. And he brings Nashville heavyweights with him. And once again, this is a full-on arena show. So this is big lights, great sound, superb performance, awesome stage in a very intimate setting. So it's going to be a great show. So I'm kind of shocked that there are tickets left. But yes, there are seats left.
Mm-hmm. And given everything we just talked about, this is a big show COVID-19 rates on the rise. You say that you just don't think there's much appetite for requiring masks?
Not so far, not from what we've heard. I mean, personally, I don't have a problem going out in public wearing a mask, but I was on Main Street a couple days ago and not a mask in sight. I mean, folks, it just seems like the public, even in Park City, as progressive as we are, doesn't seem to have an appetite for that. And I will say Justin Moore I would expect our draw to be more from the Valley, especially during Pioneer Day.
Mm-hmm. Going forward with the rest of the dates this summer, if things don't improve and get worse, which unfortunately sounds like we're headed in that direction based on what we're hearing from some of our health experts, how could the summer schedule change for the Institute?
Well, we've got two series going on right now. So starting August 8th, the Chamber Music Series starts up in the afternoons. We don't expect a lot of people to attend those shows. So I think that show will be an easy one for us to continue to have. They're usually on a Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, and we'll be able to space those out easily. The bigger shows, so we're talking about Robert Cray, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, those are going to be, the tickets are selling well, but once again, we're able to space those out. Every contract we sign has a COVID mitigation clause in it. So in the past, this wasn't the case. If we have to cancel a show, we'll call up the artist. We get all our deposits back minus their actual cost. So if they happen to fly out here in the day of the show, we even have to cancel, we will. And we'll, of course, honor the seats for the rescheduled date, allow people to apply those tickets to future shows, which I'm going to say, knowing what I know about the winter season, people are going to be very excited. There'll be more shows. They'll be able to use them then. And of course, if people really request refunds, we offer those as well.
Are there any plans for any sort of backup outdoor venue in case things really go downhill?
No, we wouldn't do that. The outdoor venue for us, we're targeting summer of 2022. So it's very expensive. I would say cost prohibitive to go outside. When you book a show, you book all the tech for it in advance. Inside tech and outside tech are very different. Our theater, it has a great sound system built in. We use that. The lighting is all there. We have to augment with some lights. And then, like last week, the band comes with their own stuff. So switching that to an outdoor venue right now would be, I would say, impossible. So if COVID rises to the point where we need to cancel a show, we'll do that. We'll cancel a show because it's, as much as we like having live shows, it's much more important to keep people safe.
Yes, indeed. Given that you had to cancel so many things last year, are you prepared for anything like that to happen with the Institute? I know financials for nonprofits have been a big issue for the past year. Are you prepared for something like that?
Yeah, it's funny. Last March when I took over, first thing I did was close everything down, and I was in meetings with other executive directors, and they said, well, now's the time to tap into your reserves. At that point, the Institute didn't have reserves. We were underwater. Now we do have some reserves thanks to, city, county, state, federal funding, but more importantly, all of our patrons who stepped up and gave us money. And we're in a better position financially. We've cut our costs, our ongoing costs now 75%. So we're much leaner. We're able to respond to those things. And because we're writing the right kinds of contracts, we're prepared for those things like we weren't before. So I think all of the performing arts organizations kind of got used to, you're definitely going to have a show. Nothing's going to happen. We can pay these people deposits that aren't refundable. And it was rare that something happened and you had to cancel a show. Now, talking to Randy and Brian and everyone else, we're all including that language in our contracts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly hope you don't lose any of those shows the rest of the summer. I know Park City Institute is a staple of the nonprofit community here in Summit County. Ari, anything else you want to add before we let you go?
Yeah, I am very excited about the new chamber music series. So I know you've had people on the air talking about it. If you go to parkcityinstitute.org, you'll see the tickets. There's four great shows there, $35 inside, a totally acoustic show. I think people will be thrilled.
And ParkCityInstitute.org is also where you buy Justin Moore tickets for
yes,
Saturday?
Yes, Justin Moore, and we still have tickets available for Big Bad Voodoo Daddy and the other popular shows. So
great. Ari, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Ari Ioannidis with the Park City Institute talking about this Saturday's Justin Moore concert at the Eccles Center for Performing Arts.